Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is a writer and journalist, editor-at-large at Time Magazine, and his most recent book is Rise to Greatness, Abraham Lincoln and America's Most Perilous Year. David von Drehle is also author of Triangle, The Fire That Changed America. The book is an interesting one. It looks at, it's a month-by-month description of all that was going on, and you can't believe all that was going on. What a year in American history. 1862 is the year, and it begins with not high hopes for the Union Army. They've suffered a lot of defeats. The Confederacy is close to Washington, D.C. People think that Abraham Lincoln is kind of a country bumpkin, and it goes month by month to a change, a dramatic change that takes place perhaps in his mind and his thoughts and his execution of the war, and a change in the way the war is being conducted with some more Union victories and an Emancipation Proclamation by the end of the year. So it indeed is very dramatic. And what gets me in reading about this is, if you think about what could have happened if things had gone the other way, there wouldn't be a United States of America, and who knows what we'd be living in. So I agree, it was a very crucial year. David is with us this hour to talk about that year, and our phone number for you to join the conversation is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page, should you care to leave messages there, and we hope you will, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. David von Drehle, thank you so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
And for writing about Abraham Lincoln, one of my favorite human beings in the whole world. There's something about him that I'm sure you're, well, you even more than I am, or most of us, but there's something totally captivating about this man, isn't there?
There is, absolutely. Somebody has estimated that there have been 16,000 books written about Abraham Lincoln, everything from huge, sprawling 10-volume biographies to little books about his pets, his children, even his dog, his hat. I think the magic, the draw of Lincoln is kind of two-sided. In one respect, he's immensely charismatic. He was, in his own time, this magnetic, charismatic figure who, when he first walked out of the wilderness into the village of New Salem, Illinois, leaving his father's farm to make his own way in the world, a complete stranger, a tremendously odd-looking character, gangly, dressed in pants that were too small for him, that barely went down to his shins, and yet this uneducated boy was, within a few weeks, the leading figure of the community and running for the state legislature. People were drawn to Lincoln, and of course he reached the highest office in the land. At the same time, though, there was this quality of Lincoln that, almost like a veil or a curtain that came down the closer you got to him. One of his intimates called him the loneliest man who ever lived. Another said to a biographer after Lincoln was assassinated, warned the biographer that he could tell which people didn't really know Lincoln by whether they described themselves as his friends. He said Abraham Lincoln didn't have any true friends. He kept the world at a distance, and so even as he pulls us toward him, we reach a point where that curtain comes down, and behind that is a mystery, an enigma, and that that too, I think, causes us to want to keep digging, keep trying to understand this really pivotal figure in not just American history, but world history.
Probably in 1862, more than any other years, Americans on the whole realized who this man was, the depth of the man. You write that he was seen as feckless and inadequate. Even at the beginning of 1862, many thought he just wasn't up to the task. By the end of the year, I would imagine people were thinking differently.
People were starting to get it by the end of 1862. There still were people who missed it because they were not seeing the forest and just seeing the trees. But by as that year played out, we see people like William Seward, the Secretary of State, who began the administration as a great rival of Lincoln and even offered at the outset of the administration to sort of take over the presidency from Lincoln because he felt Lincoln wasn't up to it. By 1862, as the year played out, Seward was quoted saying, "He's the best of us." People were beginning to recognize his greatness, and it was a greatness that developed. You know, he was really shaped and forged by the pressure of that extraordinary year, and that's what I try to show. But yes, at the beginning of the year, there's this very dramatic moment on New Year's Eve as the 1862 is about to dawn. The new Congressional Joint Committee on the Conduct of the War comes to the White House to interrogate Lincoln about why these Union armies are stuck, why nothing good seems to be happening, why the banks have are now refusing to redeem U.S. currency. There's a crisis of confidence all across the country. And as this meeting goes on that New Year's Eve, it dawns on everybody in the room that Lincoln has been completely frozen out of the planning by his general, George McClellan, that he really doesn't know what's going on with the army, that he doesn't have a grip on the War Department. It's such a striking meeting that the Attorney General, Edward Bates, went home and wrote for hours trying to get it all down in his diary. And his conclusion that night was that Lincoln, while an honest man and a man of good character, lacked will and force and has not the power to command. So that's what he was looking like, even to friendly observers, at the beginning of the year.
When did he decide that McClellan had to go, and when did he make a transition to insisting that that he get knowledge of plans that were being prepared by this terribly ineffectual general?
Yeah, it really, there was a cloud that night, that New Year's Eve, that ultimately had a silver lining. McClellan was desperately ill with typhoid fever. Many people thought he was going to die. This was obviously dangerous since he was the only one who knew what was going on, but it created an opening for Lincoln to use a new technology, the telegraph, to open communications with the next tier of generals spread out across the country, men like Henry Halleck and Don Carlos Buell in the West. And it was this foray, the New Year's Day, 1862, Lincoln's first communications with his second tier of generals that allowed him to begin to assert his authority as commander-in-chief. The story of Lincoln's relationship with McClellan is almost a soap opera that drags on through the whole year, with McClellan as the emotional diva and Lincoln trying every which way to gain McClellan's confidence and bolster him to be more aggressive against Lee's army in the East. And it's hard to tell when Lincoln decided he would ultimately get rid of McClellan, because Lincoln was a great politician and he never made decisions that he couldn't execute politically. And one thing to keep in mind is that Abraham Lincoln, when he was elected in 1860, was our least popular president in history. He got less than 40% of the popular vote, the only man ever to gain that office with such a small percentage of the vote. McClellan, meanwhile, was very popular, especially with Democrats, the opposition party. Lincoln said at one point, he's a majority general and I'm a minority president. So Lincoln had to build over the course of the year his own political capital, pile it up painstakingly. And it was only after the congressional elections of 1862, when Lincoln's Republican Party was able to retain the House and the Senate and most of the governorships across the North, that Lincoln felt strong enough to fire McClellan.
Let's talk about the strength of the Confederacy at the beginning of the year, too, because as I was reading what you were writing, I'm thinking, oh, my gosh, the odds were just really against the Union succeeding here. You talk about the number of soldiers that the Confederacy had, more than any European power had ever achieved, experienced military men, starting with President Jefferson Davis, also this huge, powerful economic weapon, which was near total control of the global cotton supply, which put France and England ready to maybe join the Confederacy because they needed that supply. I mean, the odds against the Union were pretty formidable, weren't they?
They were. No less a statesman than Lord Palmerston, the Prime Minister of Great Britain, who at that point was 77 years old, I think, and had been in the upper echelons of British government, the most powerful country in the world, for half a century. He'd seen it all, and he told his foreign ministry it was almost without a doubt that the North would not be able to subdue the South. For one thing, in addition to those points that you've already made, all true, the Confederacy covered a huge amount of real estate. Mm. It was bigger than all of Europe conquered by Napoleon. And the lines of communication into the South were very rudimentary. Dirt roads, only two north-south railroad lines. Rivers were the key highways that the North would have to use to try to penetrate the South. And when Europeans looked at this vast expanse, they would say, there's no way you can conquer and subdue all of that. They predicted that the Confederate army would just vanish into the hills and backwoods and wage a guerrilla campaign, if nothing else. And so one of the really underappreciated skills that Lincoln had to show that year was extraordinary diplomatic flexibility in keeping Great Britain and France out of the war.
Oh, my gosh. To say nothing of everything else that was on his plate, including right. What was going on in his family, which was so tragic. Let's talk about the issue of slavery, David. And you've written a lot about the abolitionists who visited him frequently during this year and really wanted him to address this. How did he frame in the beginning of 1862 what the reason was for Union soldiers to fight this war? And did he include more mentions of fighting slavery during the course of 1862?
Yeah, it was a very fluid, very dynamic process. What Lincoln used to say around the beginning of 1862, late 1861, was that the whole key to Union victory, to restoring the United States, was to hold the northern states together, which was not as easy as you might think. I mean, four of the loyal states were slave states: Kentucky, Missouri, Maryland, and Delaware. There were just about as many Democrats in the North as there were Republicans, and even all the Republicans were not necessarily abolitionists. The one thing that everybody in the North agreed on was that they wanted to restore the Union, that they did not want to see this idea of secession vindicated. They knew something we've tended to forget, that if the South was able to secede from the North, there was nothing to stop, say, the far West, California, Oregon, Nevada Territory, from seceding. There was no connection, really, to the East. The Midwest, what we now call the Midwest, it was more connected via the Mississippi River to New Orleans than it was to, say, Boston. And so these states did not want to see their country broken up. And so Lincoln emphasized this idea of union from the beginning rather than the more divisive issue of slavery. But he knew that the two issues were connected. As he said in his first inaugural address, the only difference, real difference between the North and the South is over slavery. That's at the root of all this. And so he started the year trying to push a gradual proposal by which the federal government would pay slave owners $500 each for their slaves, who would then be emancipated in a sort of gradual way over a number of years. He said this process will be as gentle as the dews falling from heaven. He didn't get any takers, not even in Delaware, where there were only about 1,800 slaves by that point. Slavery was nearly a dead letter in Delaware, but people wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole. And so gradually, little by little, Lincoln realized that he had to take more dramatic steps, and that's what pushed him toward the Emancipation Proclamation.
Mm-hmm. And he did indeed have abolitionists who would come to his door all the time,
constantly. These were the most progressive wing of his own Republican Party, and he was very sympathetic to them. He said of himself that, "I can't remember a time in my life when I didn't feel slavery was a grave moral wrong." He really believed that it was wrong. He did not see, in a country where the Constitution recognized slavery, he couldn't see that he had personal power to end slavery. What he came to understand, though, was that slaves in the South had become, over the course of this year, as the war became a cataclysm, he came to see that the slave labor force in the South was a weapon of war. You had the slaves digging the trenches so that more of the Confederate soldiers could fight in them. The slaves were cooking the meals. They were driving the mule trains. And back home, they were raising the crops to feed the rebel forces. And so Lincoln realized that his war powers as president allowed him to attack at the, not just on the battlefields, but to weaken the economy of the South, and that freeing the slaves would be legal under that power.
We welcome phone calls for you, David, and we'll take them in a moment. Our guest this hour is the author of Rise to Greatness, David von Drehle, and it looks at the year 1862. It was the year, as one U.S. senator, David recalls, presciently observed, "Never has there been a moment in history when so much was all compressed into a little time, and never since the founding of the country had so much depended on the judgment, the cunning, the timing, and the sheer endurance of one man." David is editor-at-large at Time magazine. He's also author of Triangle, The Fire That Changed America. We'll be welcoming phone calls at 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And you can always leave messages for us on our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Feel free to join our conversation whenever you'd like. We're speaking with the author of Rise to Greatness, Abraham Lincoln and America's Most Perilous Year, the year that is documented quite thoroughly and in a very compelling fashion, is 1862. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Let's go into areas other than war for just a moment, because there were so many other things that happened in 1862. The funding of the Transcontinental Railroad, land-grant colleges, the Bureau of Agriculture. Government was pretty busy in other areas as well, right?
Yes. The Republican Party was governing for the first time in its history. It was only 6 years old. And so while they weren't necessarily entirely skilled at running the government, they were bursting with ideas. And some of them were among the best ideas we've had in our history, like the Transcontinental Railroad, the Homestead Act of 1862, and my favorite, the Land-Grant College Act, which really is so forward-looking, the idea of using the national treasure of the Western lands as an endowment for institutions of higher learning, specifically to serve the children of working class and farmers. It's such an engine of upward mobility, creativity, innovation, and culture in the history of our country. Some of our greatest institutions, University of California, the University of Wisconsin at Madison, in your neck of the woods, Michigan, on and on and on, list of schools that were created by that bill in 1862. It's arguably the most consequential Congress in our history.
Isn't it amazing they were able to accomplish all of that while conducting a war, a really significant, horrible war?
It's astonishing to me, but as I thought about it, Kathleen, one of the things that struck me was that, in fact, these two things were related, because this was the year that people realized how horrible this Civil War was going to be. At the beginning of 1862, most people thought that it would be a short war that would come to a conclusion when, with a few victories on one side or the other, and the rest would give up. Then we had battles like Shiloh in the first weekend of April 1862, when more Americans were killed in one battle than in all the wars the nation had fought put together. And then a few weeks later, the 7 days battles outside Richmond, where the carnage once again was numbered in the tens of thousands. And then September 17th, 1862, at Antietam in western Maryland, where more Americans died in one day than in any other day in our nation's history, right up to now. As they saw this, a lot of people asked themselves, understandably, why are we doing this? What is this for? Do we have to go through this? And this vision that Lincoln had, and his party also, of what the country could be, of this future of a prosperous, peaceful nation from sea to shining sea, a land of opportunity, a land where people could rise as high as their talents and hard work would carry them, this land of freedom, the new birth of freedom that Lincoln talked about at Gettysburg. The fact that they had this vision is what carried them through the war. Had it just been for power, had it just been for personal glory, I don't think they could have rallied the nation to the sacrifice that was required. So this visionary quality and the ability to fight the war, I think, are see it through to its conclusion. I think they're intimately related.
We welcome phone calls, 800-486-8655. Tom in Toma is our first caller. David, hi, Tom.
Hi. My question was regarding the accuracy of Steven Spielberg's movie when he portrays Lincoln as somewhat corrupt in that he bought votes for his Emancipation Proclamation.
Yes. The movie creates a few dramatic moments in service of telling the story, but it's a true story, and I think it's a very amazingly accurate portrayal of Lincoln. Lincoln was very much a politician, and patronage, job swapping, contracts, issuing of contracts. All of this was a very important part of politics, of building coalitions, and Lincoln was a master at doling them out. People used to complain about how much time he spent paying attention to, say, who would be the postmaster in some town in Illinois or Indiana or Ohio or Pennsylvania. They didn't necessarily see what Lincoln saw, which was that this is how he held the Union together. This is how he kept people on his team, was by sharing the spoils of government and passing them around. So yes, that piece of it is absolutely real, and I've said several times in talking about this book, when our country finds itself in a difficult period, as it certainly was then, and I think it's fair to say we're in a difficult period now, there's a tendency to wish that we could find some leader or leaders who would rise above politics, who would, get beyond politics. And what I realized by studying Lincoln is that the tougher situation we're in, the better politicians we need. And Lincoln's success, first and foremost, rested on the fact that he was the greatest politician of his generation. There were other qualities that he brought to bear as well. His visionary quality that I talked about, his endurance, his determination, his patience, his immunity to attack. He didn't really care what people said about him. All that was important, but had he not been a great politician, with all the compromises and sometimes unpleasantries that implies, he never could have held the Union together.
Well, maybe we just need to get Daniel Day Lewis to run for office. And he's obviously fallen under the spell of Lincoln himself, hasn't he? Thank you, Tom, very much for the call. We must talk about the personal tragedies that befell him and his wife during this year. They lost their middle son. Mary, by all accounts, really had a breakdown over this. So even a place where you could go to get comfort and cuddle and love, all of that must have just weighed so heavily on his soul, David.
Yes. The death of Willie Lincoln at age 11 in February of 1862 is such a sad, sad story. Lincoln, one of his intimates said, Lincoln was fonder of that boy than of anything else in the world.
Oh.
They were very much alike. They were both poetic souls. They had a sort of natural gift for understanding people and situations. Willie was wise beyond his years. And he fell sick with typhoid fever, suffered for weeks and died. Mary was wrecked by this. She locked herself in her room and didn't come out for weeks after the death. Tad, the youngest, and a very sad story. His mother couldn't bear to hear the sound of children in the house after Willie died, and so she forbade their best friends, the Taft boys, from ever coming to the White House again. Mm. So Tad not only lost his beloved brother, but he also never saw his two best friends again after the death. And all of the emotional needs of Mary and of Tad fell to Lincoln, who himself was absolutely wrecked by grief. And so Tom asked about the movie. One of the most affecting moments in the movie shows Lincoln coming in and to his office and finding Tad asleep on the floor and getting down on the floor with him and picking him up to carry him to bed. That was a frequent occurrence in 1862 as Lincoln ministered to the needs of this lonely little boy.
Was there anybody during that time, because it's so hard to imagine, David, the weight of the war, the conducting the war, and the immense tragedy of that war as well, to combine that with what's going on in your family, you would think that all of us need somebody who can just let us cry or hold us. Did anybody minister to him?
He had a couple of people in his life. One was a nurse, Rebecca Pomeroy, the superintendent of the Union Army nurses, Dorothea Dix, came to Lincoln when Willie died and asked what help she could provide. And he said, I need a nurse here, because Tad was sick as well, and Mary was sick. And so she sent over a widow from Massachusetts, Rebecca Pomeroy. And Lincoln sat up with her through many afternoons and evenings, mostly talking about Pomeroy's religious faith. He was interested in how she could lose most of her family and yet maintain a certain obvious serenity and peace. And they wrestled with that. He also had an acquaintance from Illinois, Orville Hickman Browning, who they'd been lawyers together in Illinois, and Browning had been sent to Washington to fill the vacant Senate seat of Stephen A. Douglas, who died in 1861. Browning, especially after Willie's death, became a kind of confidant to Lincoln, and he kept a very good diary that year and recounts a number of scenes where Lincoln sat up with him reading poetry, talking about life, and yes, once or twice ending up in tears.
Here's an email from Willem and Colfax. The effect of the Chinese Civil War going on at the same time as the U.S. Civil War, he would like for you to talk about how that impacted England's decision to support the South and their cotton.
I'm far from an authority on Chinese history. I can say that in the American diplomatic exchanges with Britain, China was not a factor. England had been trying for years to get a cotton crop going in India, and was not having much success. France was at the same time trying to get cotton going in Egypt, which eventually happened, but it wasn't going very well then. And so this was the reason that the southern cotton embargo was so perilous to the Europeans. Cotton was the crop fueling the Industrial Revolution at that point, the textile mills of France and England. And so these countries were looking at having millions of workers out of work and potentially starving. And so they wanted that American war over as quickly as possible. The real reason that England never came in on the side of the South to try to force an end to the war was complicated. There were a couple of things at work. At the beginning of the year, Lincoln was able to persuade Britain to give the North a chance, let us get our boots on, as he put it. Then there were, in the early part of the year, some important Union victories. A young general in the West named Grant,
yes,
charged up the Tennessee and Cumberland rivers into the South and won victories that led Union troops all the way into northern Mississippi and Alabama. Meanwhile, David Farragut was able to capture the largest city in the South, New Orleans. And so Britain looked at that and said, well, maybe they're about to win. As the year went on and the tables turned and the Union situation looked very dire, the cabinet prepared to recognize the South, but then Lincoln, after the Battle of Antietam issued his Emancipation Proclamation, said he was going to sign it in 100 days. And this really made it politically impossible for the British government to intervene, because the middle class of England, the rising middle class and working classes, were very proud of Britain's role in ending the slave trade. They were pro-abolition, and so they were not going to come in on the side of a slave empire.
And wise politician that he was, Lincoln no doubt knew that, so the timing of the proclamation was with that in mind?
Partially, yes. He said he was confident this would help in Europe. He wasn't sure it was going to help him in the United States. I mean, the question was, a lot of people felt that much of the Union Army would throw down its rifles and desert, that they weren't going to fight a war over slavery. That didn't happen. People were worried that the Democrats would have a huge landslide at the polls. That didn't happen either. So Lincoln was taking considerable risk in September when he announced the Emancipation Proclamation. He had to he was gambling, and he had to win the gamble with the army. He had to win the gamble with the voters, but he was pretty sure he would win the gamble with England.
Mm-hmm. Let's spend a little more time talking about Ulysses Grant, because he's worth talking about. And I'm wondering about his rise during 1862, when he came to Lincoln's attention, and why in the world he didn't have a more prominent place earlier.
Yeah, Grant is a fascinating character. He was when the war broke out, you know, there was not a single man in the Northern Army, the U.S. Army, under the age of 60 years old, who had ever led more than a couple hundred troops in battle. Suddenly, these characters who had been lieutenants in the Mexican-American War 15 years earlier were being called on to serve as generals of vast armies. Grant wrote in a letter in late 1861 that he did not believe he was competent to lead 1,000 men, a regiment. And yet by February, he was leading 17,000 men in a hugely successful campaign in Tennessee. By April, he was in command of 50,000 men, and by the end of the year, he was in command of 100,000 troops. This meteoric rise that he went through really paralleled what was going on with a lot of other generals. The same thing can be said of Buell, of Halleck, of McClellan, for that matter. Most of these generals, their rapid rise revealed their weaknesses. In Grant's case, it was the opposite. He learned some hard lessons that year, but every lesson improved him as a general. And by the end of the year, he was poised for what is, I think, generally viewed as his greatest military campaign, the Vicksburg Campaign, which he launched early in 1863.
We welcome phone calls for our guests this hour. If you'd like to join us, feel free. Maybe you could answer the question. Would you agree that 1862 may indeed have been the most important year in American history? That's the year that is outlined in a very thorough and highly readable book by our guest this hour, David von Drehle. David is editor-at-large at Time Magazine, and his latest book is Rise to Greatness, Abraham Lincoln and America's Most Perilous Year. Our phone number, if you would like to join us, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and the Facebook page, if you would like to leave a message there, is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. David Vondrelli, our guest, our phone number, 800-486-8655. And before we go to the many calls that are coming in, David, I just want to talk about, Steven Spielberg has discussed this. Certainly Daniel Day-Lewis has discussed this. So many historians talk about falling under a Lincoln spell. And from reading big chunks of your book, I would expect that the same has happened to you. It certainly has happened to me in my lifetime. You just can't get enough of who this person is. He's endlessly fascinating. I read about him all the time, and he sort of takes over a part of your mind and your heart, I think, forever.
He does. He's so intensely human. He's got a little bit of everything, in a way, contained in him. His favorite writer is Shakespeare, and it's been said of Shakespeare that he had all of humanity in his soul. Lincoln, some of that too. You know, he's incredibly gentle with children and people, but at the same time, he's got this iron constitution, this ability to see the most terrible war of our history through to its conclusion. He is funny, incredibly funny, but also, you know, sad, a very sad man. He's brilliant, and yet can put all of his thoughts into the plainest possible language. He's the most powerful man in the country, and yet he comes from the humblest circumstances. In a sense, he contains all of life in some way, and so he does. He rewards this study, and the last thing I'd say about him is he really is the American dream story, and that speaks to, I think, all of us across time. The idea that that this is a place, ideally when it's working right, where anybody can rise to achieve whatever their ambitions are, whether it's to be a great president or to be the head of a company or to be a writer of books and, you know, magazine stories that, you know, which I dreamed of being when I was a kid. So, yes, he is incredibly fascinating.
Yes. Tom in Fenimore. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi.
I'd like to correct this man on his assumptions of General Grant. He has apparently not really studied his history very well. He would read the book Master of War about George Thomas and follow that down about how Grant should have been cashiered right after the Battle of Shiloh, which was a total disaster for the Union. His other mistakes were he should have been on the battlefield where he was basically drunk, how he sacrificed troops at Cold Harbor because he never even checked out the battle plans. Battle of the Wilderness. You know, the man was not competent, but he was there because of politics.
David.
Yeah, well, all generals in the Civil War were where they were because of politics, because it was a volunteer army and the officers were elected. So Grant was not unique in that way. George Thomas was a great general, the Rock of Chickamauga, and was probably underused also for political reasons in the war because he was a loyal general, but he came from Virginia, and people were suspicious of his loyalties all through the war, unfairly so. He had a lot of resentments about Grant, and his memoir is a catalog of all the criticisms that were made of Grant during his lifetime. Grant did make mistakes at Shiloh, and they're written about in my book, but that ultimately was a Union victory, and no less an authority than William Sherman gave Grant the credit for that victory. As for Cold Harbor, Grant in his own memoirs said it was the biggest mistake of his career. If the caller can find a general in the Civil War who made no mistakes, then I'd be interested in who that is. Grant, at the end of the day, the scoreboard showed Grant as the winner of the war.
Right.
He captured more, took the surrender of three different Confederate armies in the course of his war, and was the commanding officer at most of the key victories of the war, from Vicksburg to Chattanooga to Appomattox.
Let's go to a Facebook post. Could you, David, discuss Matthew Brady's photos at such battles as Antietam and what effect they had on Lincoln and the Northern public as a whole?
Oh, that's a great question. It's actually Brady's assistant, Alexander Gardner, who went to Antietam after that battle and took what are the only pictures of Lincoln made in the year 1862. And Lincoln, he really did have an appreciation for this new technology of photography to speak to the American public. And he would go when he had time to have portraits made and so forth. But at Antietam, he didn't have a formal portrait made. Instead, he had what were, you know, that in that era, version of spontaneous news photos made of him standing with and sitting at a table with McClellan talking to him. And the reason he did that was people wanted to know whether he supported the army. McClellan was complaining behind Lincoln's back that Lincoln was undermining him, that he didn't want to give him the tools he needed to win the war because he was jealous of a Democratic general, talking about military politics. And here was Lincoln's opportunity to show the whole country that he was going the extra mile, traveling to sit with McClellan, hear McClellan out, and it was documented by Gardner's camera. Gardner also took pictures of the battlefield, and the New York Times, when those were shown in New York, said it was as if the dead of this war have been laid at our doorsteps. It was part of this dawning realization across the country of how horrible this conflict was going to be.
Let's go to Tim in Black River Falls. Hi, Tim.
Yes, ma'am. My question is, and then I have a comment. My question to your guest is, would he have any president outside of Lincoln that he would compare to Lincoln, modern day or historic, that would come close to the, you know, the stature that Lincoln attained?
There are various presidents who had certain qualities that I think are similar. Reagan used storytelling much the way Lincoln did, you know, as a kind of defense mechanism to keep people happy when he couldn't give them what they wanted. You know, Lincoln and Reagan did this as well, would launch into, you know, amusing stories to keep their visitors from talking about unpleasant subjects. You could certainly talk, look at Franklin Roosevelt as someone who lived through an incredibly tumultuous presidency and galvanized a divided country under a lot of pressure. You could look at George Washington as another president who, if he hadn't come along when he did, we might not have our country. You know, Washington got us started and Lincoln kept us together. But I don't think there's another president who in 4 years took the country through the kind of existential crisis that Lincoln had to guide us through. That was the moment when the United States was either going to live or die.
Mm-hmm. When the whole idea, as you write, of constitutional government in a diverse nation was going to survive or not.
That's right. Could you have could this idea of elected government work?
Yes.
Basically, as Lincoln saw it, what the South was saying is, if we are unhappy enough with an election result, we can break up the country. And Lincoln saw, that was not, if that was the case, then elected government was impossible.
Yeah. Oh, David, thank you so much for being with us. I just love these shows on Lincoln, and your book is so well done. I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
David Vondrely, editor-at-large at Time Magazine, author of Rise to Greatness, Abraham Lincoln and America's Most Perilous Year. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Katie Mattson for on-air production in our studios in Milwaukee. Great talks ahead.